I would be remiss in my duty if I did not tell you that the idea of intercourse, the fact of your firm young body co-mingling with the zombie take out makes me want to vomit.
What's up? Welcome to episode 412 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we've got some news. This is from Nerdist. John Boyega's had recent Attack the Block sequel discussions. John Boyega has been making headlines recently due to his incredibly powerful speeches during the Black Lives Matter protests in London. And he's also... He also may have some exciting acting news to share in the not too distant future. Attack the Block director Joe Cornish chatted with Script Apart podcast via Empire for a recent interview. He discussed the possibility of a sequel to the sci-fi comedy horror film, saying, quote, "We've got ideas. I met with John a couple of months ago to talk about it. We've always had ideas after the first one, but obviously we've both been busy doing very different things." Cornish went on to explain that ever since Attack the Block came out, they have talked about what a sequel would look like, saying, quote, "In a way, the longer you leave it, the more interesting it is." He also explained, so that's all I'll say. When asked the question if there would be a sequel in 2019, Boyega told Entertainment Weekly, quote, "If the supporters want it, then I'll have to go back to Peckham ASAP. He tweeted about Cornish's recent statements as well, saying, quote, "I think I'm going to need the whole of London as an army on this one." I normally would say no to a sequel nearly 10 years later. Attack the Block was 2012.
Fuck, it was really that long ago?
It was 2012, but I love Attack the Block. I don't know where they would go. I mean, unless the aliens attack again and Moses once again just happens to be there. I'm curious. But
it's kind of a diehard thing then, huh?
Pretty much.
Same guy again, really?
But Boyega needs to shake Finn. Going back to Moses, I think, is a good move. And it plays well with his... you know, the press he's gotten for the protests. It'll be a couple years away, obviously, because nobody's going to be making movies in the near future.
Yeah, I kind of found it wild to hear about movies and things, in process or
Well, it's in talks. So it's in talks. Are you into it? So we can set it up for when we can actually make movies again.
I am surprised he's sticking with the sci-fi thing and not moving out,
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to see him branch out, but I'm a sucker for Attack the Block. I'd love to see more. And, like I said, shake Finn.
like Kylo Ren, kind of pushed out into other things. But then again, he was
doing that beforehand. He was never, he wasn't a sci-fi guy before. He was well established before Star Wars.
Adam that's Driver. True. That is.
So, and he was not a sci-fi guy. So, he's just going back to his normal thing. So, yeah, I'm curious to see that. Anyway, on to this week's movie, which is from 1971, Harold and Maude. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by the Jaguar Hearse, new for 1971. All the performance you've come to expect from a Jaguar with the somber look of a hearse, and with only a little less carrying capacity. Try one at your next funeral.
And also brought to you by Maude's Car Sharing Service. It's nice to have a variety of experiences. Paint not included. All right, so we have a young man, fortunately not too young. He's 23, folks.
Bud Cort was, I think, 22 or 23 when the movie was made. He looks 12.
Yeah, he looked super young, and it was kind of like... but anyway, he's living with his mom, and she is just... she's kind of oblivious, but... he apparently has put up so many antics that he has made her, I guess, numb to his work.
He likes faking his own death.
Yes, he performance art of suicide scenarios in the house, in the yard. And it's so matter of fact that they, you know, they're almost trauma quality, scenes.
She doesn't react to any of them until he messes up her bathroom with fake blood for one. And then she's like, okay, that's enough.
Yeah. Until she makes a mess, then he's gone too far. Well, it's all about straightening this kid out. Really, if you sum up the different things, you have the mom that believes in the materialism. She sends him to the shrink, who, of course, I mean, I guess, you know, Freudian, you know, psychotherapy.
Yeah, very Freudian. It was the early 70s.
And, or she tries to send him to his uncle, who, of course, is the military guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember, there's one other. Oh, yes, the priest, who tries to talk some sense into him, too.
Yeah,
but in reality, well, he has this pre-fight club thing about going to funerals. I'm surprised no one called out Fight Club for ripping this whole shtick off. But it's just they were doing Harold and Maude with. In fact, did we do Fight Club, and we should have had a Harold and Maude title to it.
If we did, and I don't remember if we ever reviewed Fight Club, I'll have to check when we're done recording.
Problem with reviewing over 400 and something movies.
But I hadn't really seen, I don't think I'd seen Harold and Maude before today. If I had, it was many years ago and I'd forgotten about it, so.
They both enjoy going to different funerals.
He meets an old elderly woman at one of the funerals.
Right, and they is this elderly woman who also enjoys going to funerals. Not as respectful as Harold at the funeral. She doesn't mind making a scene or hissing at somebody to get someone's attention. She pretty much seeks him out. You know, they both share a common interest. She invites him over.
It's a meet cute with a 79-year-old woman and a 23-year-old guy who looks 12 at a funeral.
Yeah. And, she is pretty much just the free spirit of just do what makes you happy. Don't worry about what other people think. And go for as many experiences as possible. Now,
but she also pushes it too far.
Yeah.
He's kind of caught between these two extremes.
Right. And she pushes it too far because she has they imply that she has seen some extreme shit.
Yeah. She steals cars on the regular.
But they imply that, you know, they make references to two of the worst cases of anti-Semitism in like the same scene, you know, where she's talking about somebody being imprisoned. And then glance down and just casually see the number tattoos from Auschwitz on her arm.
Right.
And they build it turns into a romantic relationship. And I don't know if I could say hilarity ensues or if I just go all the way with it.
Yeah, let's go all the way. There will be spoilers in this. Let's just say that. Because I don't think we can talk about this movie without spoiling the ending.
You're probably right, because the ending is just, I mean, it's just a big part of the film.
It's so, free on Tubi, so if you haven't seen it, pause and go watch now.
So, right, he pretty much has the moment of clarity where this is, I mean, his mom had been trying to fix him up with women and telling him to marry, so he gets the bright idea, why don't I marry Maude, this elderly woman who's turning 80, and it'll be part of her 80th birthday, despite the fact that she says, I believe on two occasions,
that before this, yes,
that
that she's not going to live past her 80th birthday.
Right, her 80th birthday is it, and even said that that's enough. I've lived enough. I don't need to go any further than that. And I think it was before he really knew her, mm-hmm. when she was saying it like the first right. or second time. So I think he kind of dismissed it.
I just figured she didn't expect to live that much longer. You know, it caught me off guard too.
And you saw it coming a mile away when he's ready to pop the question. She pretty much just flat out says, "Huh, I took the tablets. I'm probably not going to make it to midnight." And then we can say hilarity ensues.
Yeah. Now, the start of the movie is something very interesting. As a former smoker, Harold is lighting these candles at this kind of altar sort of thing. He has a lighter, one of those big desk lighters, that he uses to light a match to light the candle. I mean, the lighter was big, but he picked it up. Why not just use the lighter? Why do you need the match? It's kind of an either-or thing. And they really don't wait for the suicide attempt, or the I won't say suicide attempts, but the suicide stagings.
Right.
Like in that first scene, within minutes, he's hanging himself.
I had forgotten about all these gags, actually. I don't know how I forgot about some of these things. You think they'd be pretty memorable, but the first thing I was thinking of was, whoa, if you didn't like the stuff from last week, how are you going to feel about this?
And yeah, it just catches you off guard. And then as he's hanging there, his mother walks in, ignores it. Just kind of goes about her business. She sees him, but she just goes about her business. That's the point I said I'm in.
Okay.
And a little later in the movie, he buys a hearse. I love that. He's obsessed with death.
Right.
He might have been the first goth.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm trying to think.
Because the scene goes back to like the late 70s, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it has roots before then, like everything. But, you know, goth is not... I mean, you have different kinds of goths. You have the people who are just into the music and the clothes. But really, at its core, it's about accepting death.
Well, right. Again, it is about living your life versus...
It's memento mori. You know, remember you're going to die.
Yeah.
So, you know, this in this movie is really just a big memento mori. But, you know, I have the actor's name, Harold, there he is really Bud just...
Court, was it?
Bud Cort is the actor, yeah. He's obsessed with death. So he's constant... And he's also feeling very ignored by his mother. So he's constantly faking his own death for attention. Or at least that's what it seems like at first. He's trying to shock her to get her to get an idea that she cares.
You kind of feel
at least that was my interpretation at that point.
Just to piss her off. I mean, I don't know.
But I love that he bought a hearse. I love that and the sort of abject terror on his face when he's talking to the shrink and the priest. He looks like he just saw someone die.
It looks like he's in the wrong movie. Like he should be in The Exorcist.
Yeah,
when he's talking with them.
Or just he's in the wrong movie. Like he wasn't supposed to be in that scene, and he can't figure out why he's in that scene, and it's just happening.
Which I guess is kind of how it is. Like, why the fuck am I talking to these weirdos?
Yeah. Not sure how I feel about the prosthetic arm on his uncle, the military guy, being played for a laugh.
He was the right-hand man of MacArthur.
It's 71, so I mean, you know, they were insensitive at, you know, time, so I'm not going to take away from it, but yeah.
Well, the fact that they're doing this in the middle of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, true. Very close to the end, but I think it was still going on.
Oh, there's still a few years left of the Vietnam War, so it's, you know, I mean, like, that is balls of steel to be talking about the military in the middle of a war like this.
But they kind of go on a bit of an Alice's restaurant tangent with it later.
Yeah.
The second scene with his uncle really goes Alice's restaurant, where, you know, Arlo is, you know, jumping up and down screaming, I want to kill, and is shown out.
That's right. This came like after.
Yeah, Alice's Restaurant, quite a bit. But then, you know, he goes to his second funeral, the film, I think it was. He sees her at his first funeral, an outdoor one, kind of fascinated by her. And then he goes to the second funeral, and she just kind of starts chatting him up.
Yeah, she kind of scares him at the first funeral. Mm-hmm. That second scene with MacArthur's right-hand man. Uh-huh.
For the record, I'm shaking my head.
That tactic they use, of course, would totally not have worked.
Of course.
He would have totally been into it. I would have had no problem with him killing a protester.
Oh, yeah, the later scene. Yeah. She starts chatting him up. I love the contrast, because he is quiet and creepy, and she's just really bright.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
And then she steals the priest's car.
Well, first she's driving off in the car, and you see the priest kind of hustling to get out.
And she offers him a ride home. He says, I've got my own car. She goes off, and then the priest walks out, and she stole his car. And then his mother decides she's going to try to set him up with women from a dating service.
Which
is an ongoing gag throughout the movie.
Yeah.
But when she tells him this, and she starts filling out the profile for him.
And she's answering the questions.
Yeah, for him. And he opens his case that's on his lap, takes out a gun, starts slowly loading it, points it at her for a second, then points it at himself. I'm guessing it was a starter pistol.
Yeah.
So pulls the trigger. The cherries in falls back. She's like, Harold, get up. Quit messing around.
Now, of course, my favorite suicide staging, without a doubt, was the self-immolation.
It's so subtle. I loved that scene.
As soon as I saw the robes, I was like, oh, damn, is he gonna... Oh, my God, yeah, that's a candle gun fluid.
His mother is interviewing the first prospective date from the dating service. And out the window on the mother's shot, you see someone, a human-like shape covered in these white rags or white cloth.
Well, he walks by, kind of waves in the window.
Okay, I didn't catch that.
To get their attention. But he's wearing like these white robes.
I missed that part. But then, you see this character in like this human shape in white robes. And I didn't put it together until
he walks to the second platform, covers himself with the robe, which of course is when he pulls the switcheroo and gets out of there.
This is all in the distant background in one half of a two shot.
Yes.
Or a two person scene. Back and forth shot. So I didn't catch that. I only caught it the next time. And then the second time I saw him, I'm like, wait, is he gonna and he did.
Oh man, that was that had me rolling.
Yeah, I think that might be the point where I actually laughed out loud.
Oh yes, I definitely was.
But then he comes back in after it because the date sees the body burning and screams. He walks in, which confused the hell out of me.
Right, we pulled the switcheroo. He walked by, covered himself with the thing, the ropes.
I guess he couldn't. There's no way he could fake burning himself. So, he had to have used a dummy.
Yeah.
But he walks in, and the girl is screaming. Mother's like, oh, fuck off, Harold. Or Harold. Doesn't say that, but that's her tone.
Yeah.
He gives this look to the camera and this slow smile that's just incredibly fucking creepy. Apparently, Bud Cort improvised that. That was not scripted. Before that, I loved Maud's line, how the world still dearly loves a cage.
Yeah.
She was talking about prison, and what was the other one? Oh, animals being in... Oh, zoos and prisons. She was comparing zoos and prisons, and said how the world still dearly loves a cage.
That does sum a lot of the movie up. It is about breaking from societal norms that are just crushing people.
Mm-hmm. Loves the odorifics. She has this invention where it's this tube of a smell that she puts in a device. You put a mask up to your face and you get this smell that's in the tube. Reminded me of something almost out of UHF.
Yes. Or matinee, you know?
Something. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Smell of it.
And then there was her statue. She shows in this statue that she created that she said is tactile art. You have to touch it. It's a giant vagina. She asks him what else he likes to do for fun other than going to funerals. And in the next shot, they're watching a building be demolished. As a Mythbusters fan, I totally understand the appeal of watching a building get demolished. Watching things get broken is fun.
You know, I don't think I've ever actually watched one.
I've obviously Mythbusters, they blow things up a lot. Yeah. I've seen a few buildings get demolished. Not live, but, you know, video. Something fun about seeing a big thing get broken. I think it's because, like, as a kid, your first sense of power is when you knock the blocks over.
I guess so.
You know, it's the first thing you feel like you have some control in the world is knocking over these blocks. It's kind of feeds into that. Another great line from Maud shortly after that scene. She says, I feel that much of the world's sorrow comes from people who are like this, who are this. She gestures to some daisies, yet allow themselves to be treated as that, and gestures to the building they just watched get destroyed.
Oh, I thought she was gesturing to the headstones.
Oh, okay. I assume the building, because you know, people who are, you know, flowers, these delicate flowers, but allow themselves to be broken.
The camera pans back and they're just in this thing of just a bunch of a cemetery and a bunch of...
It could have been the headstones. I assuming since they just watched the building, I thought it was that. But now, the entire score from the film, of this film, or soundtrack score, whatever you want to call it, is all Cat Stevens music. I've never been a big fan of his, but it fits the movie.
It kind of distracts, I feel, from it. I mean... I agree. It, thematically, it works, but it's like the same thing as what was it, Slapshot, where it was just like so repetitive. It was kind of like, what? I mean, is this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had one to artist throughout the whole.
I had to do the math. Cat Stevens at the time had about 60 songs in his entire catalog. Uh-huh. 9 songs were used in this movie.
Ah, okay.
15% of his fucking catalog.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, shortly after that scene, she's talking about her past. She mentions that she's from Vienna.
Right.
Where's her accent? Because she's saying she attended protests in Vienna when she, you know, she was young in Vienna and all that. She would have an accent if she was, you know, a teenager or older when she left.
I'd rather her just not than try a bad one, though. Yeah,
fair. I mean, if she said she was British, I might buy it. Right. Gordon did have that kind of, you know, mid-Atlantic accent.
Wasn't she from Jersey?
I don't know. I forgot to check. She looked good for 75, I gotta say.
Mm.
She was 75, not 79 when the movie was
made. Yeah.
Also, she's trying to get him to pick up an instrument because she loves music. She gives him a banjo. She says, you know, try playing a chord on it. Now, most people wouldn't pick up on this. The thing about banjo, it's tuned to a chord. I think it's a G. It's tuned to, like, I think it's a G chord. So all you got to do is either strum it open or bar any fret. You're playing a chord. It's pretty easy.
I don't understand why he...
And then of...
said to the girl that he was learning to play the harmonica instead of the banjo.
I loved that because banjo is kind of embarrassing. You know, banjo is not a cool instrument. I've become kind of enamored with it because of Noam Pikelny from Punch Brothers. He's incredible. Bella Fleck a little bit before that.
I guess Steve Martin's done a lot for it too.
Yeah. I mean, even back in the 70s with his comedy, but even more recently,
as
a serious musician playing bluegrass.
I'd even forgotten that he was doing that back in the 70s with his comedy.
Hell of a player. I mean, not on the Bella Fleck and Pacelny level, but still very good. Yeah. But it's still it's not a cool instrument. You know, banjo has that weird sound that can be very annoying to a lot of people. I would love one, but they typically weigh like 12 pounds, not very comfortable to play. I did love the, you know, he starts to say banjo, he actually plays harmonica. but before that, after the scene, after she gives him the banjo, there's the scene where his mother bought him a present. She's leading him out to it. You know, it's obviously going to be a car. It's this beautiful Jag.
Right. You're not expecting a Jag.
Yeah. He thanks her for it, you know, plays along. She goes, he walks off frame, comes back with a welding torch lit. I loved the expression on his face when he had the torch. You don't know what he's going to do at that point. You find out
is he just going to mangle this Jag?
Yeah. You don't know what he's going to do. A couple of scenes later, you see his handiwork. He turned it into a fucking hearse.
A Jag hearse, which was just fucking amazing, actually.
It's the it may be the one car that's cooler than the Munster Mobile. And then we get to the pro-war scene. The scene where he's talking with his uncle because she decided she's had enough of his shit and she's sending him off to join the military. Both funny and horrifying.
Right. And
his uncle's part
would not have worked.
Well, no, the uncle scene before that.
Oh, wow.
When the uncle was talking about the benefits of war, it was so straight faced, so dry that it's played very, very straight. It's super dry comedy and it's horrifying and funny at the same time. And then he starts getting overexcited about war in a very Alice's Restaurant kind of way. I want to kill, I want to kill, I want to kill. Maud shows up as this protester and there's this whole shtick that supposedly was intended to drive his uncle away and make his uncle think he's too crazy to join the military. During this whole, you know, fake fight, she falls through this hole in the floor of where they are into the water. That caught me off guard.
Right. I wasn't expecting that either.
Like, what? I didn't know if that was part of the plan or what. You know, next scene, they show him together. He tells her he loves her. I like how slowly he fell for her. It made sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it did. Because, I mean, at first, it's like crazy old lady. Oh, yeah. Nice. You know, I'm experiencing new things. And then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it made sense that this guy in his early 20s fell for this 80-year-old woman. That was a great magic trick because I knew that was going to happen. I know enough about the movie that was coming.
You do.
Even before just knowing the plot, I knew what to expect and I had no idea how they were going to pull that off. But it worked.
It's definitely the one thing you know going into this movie is that, you know, these two are hooking up.
Yeah. Now the Harry Carey scene, I have very mixed feelings about, and I say it as Harry Carey very intentionally. He's meeting one of the prospective dates and she sees these antique knives and apparently she's really into knives. Gotta love her for that. I actually kind of love this date. I was kind of rooting for her.
Yeah. You kind of like wonder why he didn't like,
because he was already in love with Maud. If it wasn't for Maud, she'd have been perfect for him.
Yeah.
He shows her these antique knives and he says, and bear in mind, I'm an anime geek. I am a borderline weeaboo. So, you know, I've been studying Japanese, blah, blah, blah. He says one of them is a Harry Carey blade. It was a tanto that was sometimes used for seppuku. Have to nitpick that. But he fakes seppuku. I can't decide if that was racist or not.
You know what I loved though? The fact that he, the part where he moves his tie.
Stabbing himself. I mean, he doesn't, like, you know, say anything in mock Japanese or anything.
Right, right.
He just sticks himself in the stomach with this, you know, folding blade and kind of falls forward.
I'm going to be the white guy that says it was not racist, and here's the reason why.
Okay. I'm probably being a little too critical. Go ahead.
He stages every form of suicide there is.
True. And that is a well-known form of suicide. Right. Fair point. And he calls it Harry Carey, which again, at the time was what it was called. Known as in the West.
The old announcer for the Chicago Cubs.
Yes. I always think of that too. Yeah. But, you know, he doesn't like mock any Japanese. He doesn't like put on a headband. There's none of that shit.
Which, so, honestly, I for guess, 71, that's damn impressive, honestly. Yeah. In 71, that would be required. Well, yeah, you gotta make fun of it, right?
So I guess it's okay. But what I loved was right after that, he goes face down and the prospective date launches into Romeo and Juliet. Yes. She's an actor.
I love that she appreciated the performance too, which I mean, you'd got to appreciate his performances. They are fucking amazing.
Oh, yeah. And while she's going through Juliet's death scene, he just kind of turns his head as he's laying there, like, what the fuck? She out-creeped him.
We missed a part, though. We missed the part of Tom Skerritt.
Okay, where was he?
He was the cop, of course.
Oh, yes. The cop.
I wonder how many cops he's played in his career.
Right.
He's always the sheriff of somewhere. Or, mm-hmm. This time he's the motorcycle cop.
She gets pulled over and, you know, she admits she had just stolen a tree. She decided they needed to rescue this tree that was on a sidewalk somewhere in the city.
They breathe carbon, you know, CO2, and
they
get choked out in the part of the forest that they planted in. But
they rescue the tree, rescue in quotes, in a stolen El Camino.
Yeah.
That gets pulled over. She admits the El Camino was stolen, and then they stole the tree from the city, and they're going to go plant it in the woods.
Well, right. She would never lie about something. This is what I did.
And then she manages to evade the cop by driving circles around him, causing his bike to fall over. I love that they brought him back later.
Yes.
He actually does. He pulls her over again. I forget how she got out of it the second time.
She stole his bike.
Oh, she's right. She stole his bike.
Well, he went in to the El Camino.
Mm-hmm.
She got on the bike and they...
Drive off.
Yeah.
This is why I say she took it to... I was kind of on her side until I really thought about the stealing cars thing. Because I'm all for following your bliss. As I said to someone on Twitter recently, you know, as long as no one gets hurt, I will always encourage shenanigans of any kind. But when you're stealing cars, you're hurting people. You know, that's too far. She's kind of objectivist.
She returned the car when she could.
Fair. But she's very objectivist. I wanted to come up with a title that mentioned Ayn Rand. Couldn't think of any.
It was like the priest said, you know, like she painted painting the statues.
Yeah. She just takes it a little too far. Otherwise, I would have been totally on board with her. one thing I forgot to mention about the scene, the Sepulchre scene. His mother walks in while the date is...
The two are lying. Bloody.
After she had finished her Juliet scene... He's standing there with the knife and she thinks he killed her. And then we get to the priest, the scene we referenced in the intro.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be funny, but it was really just upsetting.
I mean, come on. All I could think of was Finster and Sons.
Yeah, fair point.
This
go back.
Yeah, linger longer. The level of loathing and lustfulness, though, that he delivered that line.
Yeah. Oh, just, so the delivery was perfect. I have no criticisms of the actor.
Had me rolling.
I have no criticisms of the actor. Quite the contrary. It was a brilliant performance. It just upset me. For the Finster and Sons reference, zombietakeout.com, on the side, you'll see TAS question mark. It's our first podcast, the Tuesday afternoon show. I believe it was episode 7. It's all just commercial parodies.
Oh my God, you remember that?
I think it. I want to say it was 7. I have no idea what the title was. I want to say it was episode 7. But it was all ad parodies. I wrote a investment banker parody called Finster and Sons that Scott did a dead on perfect John Hasbin for.
Yeah.
Back to Harold and Maude. I loved the organic jokes. Couple of scenes, there's this wine that she's pouring for him and he doesn't drink. But she says, "That's okay, it's organic." And he laughs. Love that.
I mean, there is organic wine out there now.
But it was so ahead of its time.
Right.
Because it was a shot at organic. Organic is marketing bullshit. It means nothing.
Well, there are guidelines that you have to follow.
It's so meaningless, though.
But you know, yeah, it has been watered down.
It's no, marketing bullshit at this point.
Yeah.
And then we get to the scene that really was when I realized I am not on her side. She kills herself because she decided 80 was enough. Did not see it coming. You saw it coming a mile away. I didn't.
Well, she opened. I mean,
I know she telegraphed it.
She telegraphed. She came right out and said, "Oh yeah, that's going to be it for me after Saturday."
I didn't think it was going to be a suicide. I just didn't think she expected to live much longer.
Some people say that she had she might have had dementia, like oncoming, and decided that
they should have made that clear.
Yeah, I didn't see any. I don't recall any signs about that.
Yeah, I'm not going to shame a suicide. You know, I'm not going to go there when it's, you know, out of pain. Or, you know, assisted suicide for euthanasia, or just, you know, depression, anxiety, mental illness, one of those kind of suicides. I'm not going to shame it. She, on the other hand, just decided that was it.
She had
there was no mention of illness.
Right.
Horribly selfish. The most selfish. I mean, suicide is selfish, but when it comes out of pain, it's understandable.
So, yeah, he has the appropriate response of what?
Yeah. Has a breakdown.
Yeah.
Drives his car off a cliff.
One last suicide to a stage.
I love that the car didn't explode when it hit. Thank you for that.
I think they really did it.
I think that's what would actually have happened to that car. I think that's just what happened to the car when it landed.
Right. I read about it.
Went ass over end, landed on its top, and just crushed.
They because people always want to know like what happened to the Jaghearse, and because you know people were willing to pay like good money for it, of course, because it was fucking hot.
I'm surprised there was only one. Usually there are multiples in situations.
But yeah,
like this.
They only made one, and they fucking drove it off the cliff.
So, I mean, the parts were probably split among the crew for souvenirs, but And then we get the fake out. He wasn't in the car.
Yeah. Well,
He walks off with his banjo playing if you want to sing out.
I mean, he couldn't have really killed himself. Of course, it was just another staged suicide. You know, it was the last one in the whole series of staged suicides. He'd done everything up until that point.
Destroying the hearse, which means I think he was over that phase.
Yeah. And Maude's got him over that phase. Maude's life and death would have been meaningless if he had gone down in it. So it would have it would have been horrific if he had just decided to end it there.
On to sequels and remakes.
Well, I guess they could remake it.
Writer-producer Colin Higgins expressed interest in 1978 about both a sequel and a prequel to Harold and Maude. The sequel, Harold's Story, would have Court portraying Harold's life after Maude. Higgins also imagined a prequel showing Maude's life before Harold, Grover and Maude had Maude learning how to steal cars from Grover Muldoon, the character portrayed by Richard Pryor in Higgins' 76 film Silver Streak. Higgins wanted Gordon and Pryor to reprise their roles.
Wow. That would have been weird.
Harold's story, we kind of get it. I think, you know, seeing him walk off, you know, moving on from that phase of his life was enough.
Right. A happy, better adjusted person going out into society.
Well, no, not really happy, but, you know, better adjusted perhaps. Harold, Grover and Maude, no.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say respect to Richard Pryor, but.
I say happy, but I mean, it is that he's ready to live life now rather than just fixate on death.
Right. Also, in addition, after the film came out, the script was turned into a novel and then a play, which ran for several years in Paris. So there is also a stage version.
You know, why don't they do something where they change the genders like they do with other remakes now?
That would be a young woman and an old man would be too common anyway. That wouldn't raise any eyebrows.
I kid. You know, obviously you get Helen Mirren.
I always have this problem. I can never think of young actors. I can't think of a early 20s actor offhand. I don't see enough modern movies.
I don't know. What sold this was Bud Cort's, you know.
Yeah. You can't replace Bud Cort in that role. I can't think of anybody who could do that.
Like the eyes just bugging out of the head at some scenes. You're just like, wow.
It was made for him. On to Brains?
On to Brains.
I'm going 5, but as I mentioned to you before we recorded, this is a Black Rainbow 5. I deeply respect this movie. It has made me think more than a movie has probably since Primer. but I don't know if I liked it.
I'm going 4.5. I did really like it a lot. I think it, you know, it's a philosophy, but, I think too much Cat Stevens was a little bit of a I think if he just maybe did 3 Cat Stevens songs, maybe
you know, if you liked Cat Stevens more, my life would be a lot easier tonight. Posting on the website, on the rec list. All right. So what have we learned?
We learned that black flowers are just dead.
And I learned that everyone's got a right to make an ass out of themselves. That line reminded me so much of Arthur Waldman.
Oh.
You know, acting class, but he said to be an actor, you have to be willing to make an ass of yourself.
That is true. That is true.
All right, so that's it for Harold and Maude. Until next time, when we'll be reviewing The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I have seen that, but it has been ages, so I'm very curious to see how it's going to age.
It's been a little while, I think. I've seen it a few times.
Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.